Plenty of historical events, very far back, are well documented by lots of different sources. The rampages of Genghis Khan, the supernova of 1054, the Justinian Plague. That's because they're unusual. When something unusual happens, you write about it. You record it for posterity. We know a lot about history when the historical events we're talking about were strange to the people observing them. But a series of strange and interesting things that happened in the past isn't the definition of history. That's the definition of Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. History is about the lives of others and how we learn about the struggles of today through the struggles of ordinary people in the past. And studying that is much harder than studying great world-changing historical events, precisely because almost nobody writes about their ordinary life. Even the most prolific diary keepers of all time devote most of their diaries to the distinctive things that happen to them from day to day because their daily routine was, well, boring. The first Polish language dictionary, published in the 1700s, included definitions like horse. Everyone knows what a horse is. Why would you write about something everyone knows? We don't know the rules to ancient Roman gladiator fights, because it's not like an ad for a baseball game today would explain the rules of baseball, right? We can be pretty sure that most of them weren't actually fights to the death, but we only know that because a small minority of posters for gladiator fights we've found specifically advertise fights to the death, implying that, again, this was unusual. Your average medieval historian can explain how Charles Martel won the Battle of Poitiers, which is something your average medieval French peasant probably wouldn't know, but the peasant could definitely make a guess at what Charles ate for breakfast that morning, which we're absolutely at a loss for. In fact, there's a debate over whether medieval Europeans ate breakfast at all. We know the names of the kings and the sites of their battles, but we don't know when in the day they ate their meals. What's more basic, normal, universal, completely unworthy of writing about than color? Isn't that a universal human experience? Don't we all see the same colors? I hope at some point you were blessed with a cool middle school teacher who told you, hey, what if we all see colors completely differently? Like, what if the color that I call green is the color you call orange? We'll never know, right? Because we'll both agree that grass is green and it's a similar color to blue, which we agree is the color of the sky, but who knows if we're literally seeing the same color or something totally different. Maybe if I had your eyes, everything would be a wildly different color and the world would look like a full-on acid trip. That's fun, but probably not true. Our cone cells, the color receptors in our eyes, certainly don't vary much from person to person, as far as we can tell. Humans do, more or less, all see the same colors. But we don't describe them the same way. You and I can look at a rainbow and say Roy G. Biv. 7 easily identifiable differentiable colors, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. But that's because Sir Isaac Newton decided to split the color spectrum that way in his book Optics. He initially split it into 5 colors, red, yellow, green, blue, violet, which would be equally correct, it's just another way of humanity describing a constant of nature. Newton later chose to add orange and indigo so that the rainbow would have 7 colors, the same as notes in a musical scale, seemingly for no clear reason other than he thought equating color to music was a cool idea. And I'll give him that, it is. But how we partition the color spectrum varies by culture. This is a map of the Moscow metro. Like on plenty of transit systems, the lines are color-coded. There's the orange line, the purple line, the green line, the dark blue line, the light blue line, or as Muscovites know them, the Sini line and the Goluboy line. Dark blue and light blue are 2 entirely separate colors in the Russian language. To a Russian, they're as distinct as blue and green. You wouldn't call blue and green shades of the same color, would you? Well, they do in Japanese. In Japan, the grass and the sky are the same color, just different shades. I bet they're really confused by bluegrass music. What other color could grass be? But right up until the 19th century, the Chinese had their own distinctive color, one that they mentioned in passing a fair amount, one that was normal enough to never really get described. It was called Qing, and it doesn't easily map onto any color spectrum we know. What was the Chinese color Qing? I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian and Thimble the Doll. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. So you may have noticed a lot is different about this episode. I have facial hair now. Peep it now because I'm going to shave right after this episode. I'm on a couch. There should be a Tamil dwarf breakdancing right in front of me. My conspicuously absent background is arriving by UPS in a couple days because I just moved across the country. I live in New York now with my girlfriend. I'm as surprised as Mew, honestly. 2 weeks ago, I was in Taiwan, planning to spend the next 5 months all the way up to Chinese New Year next February there studying Mandarin. Then I realized spending long spans of time in a foreign country is a luxury I can really only do when I don't have strong attachments back home. Now I have a full-time job and a hot long-distance girlfriend. She's at work right now because you can't hear the 80s sitcom Designing Women in the background. That's how you know she's not home. This is a game of Go. You've probably heard of it. It's a strategy game with black and white stones where you win by surrounding your opponent's stones with your stones. It's sort of the Chinese equivalent of chess, culturally, although there's a different game called Xiangqi that's sometimes just called Chinese chess. Today, in Chinese, the black and white stones in Go are called Hei, for black, and Bai, for white. Pretty straightforward, those are the Chinese words for black and white. But according to historical sources, the black stones were originally called Qing. Light colors were Bai, and dark colors were Qing. So Qing was a dark color, right? This is interesting because most other sources suggest it's not. The word Qing isn't in common use for a color anymore in modern Mandarin Chinese. Depending on the tones you use, Qing means other things, most commonly please. For example, 请给我那个榴莲. It also means the Qing Dynasty, or a concept in Confucianism, analogous to emotion or introspection, but those are all different words written with different characters and have no connection to the color Qing. But the word Qing for the color has been fossilized in plenty of common noun phrases, which mostly suggest Qing was a greeny-blue color. Fresh vegetables are known as qingcai, or qing food, so qing here seems to mean green. From this, qing has connotations of freshness and newness. Qingchun, which literally means qing spring, as in the season, is a poetic term for youth. In other cases, qing unambiguously means blue. The flag of the Republic of China slash Taiwan has a mnemonic analogous to calling the American flag the Stars and Stripes, where the blue canton on the flag is referred to as qing. Qing Tian, Qing Sky, means a deep blue sky, and you'll still hear that in weather forecasts and the like to mean like a cloudless day. The coastal city of Qingdao means Qing Island, which doesn't really offer any clues, but there's a more indicative place name using Qing, the western Chinese province of Qinghai, which means Qing Sea. The province of Qinghai is very mountainous, dry, and landlocked, and the sea in question is a lake. It is very blue. Modern Chinese has standard words for blue and green, lan and lu, which are themselves extremely old and coexisted with the word qing for thousands of years, generally but not universally being considered shades of qing. In today's China, if you hear something referred to as qing without further context, that usually means cyan. Qing survived into the modern day as a name for a blue or green color in some culturally Chinese places outside mainland China. I found a Reddit thread from Singapore where people reminisced about learning Qing as the word for green in school and then were confused to hear their parents or grandparents calling blue things Qing as well. That's the explanation most people tend to run with. Qing was one of those blue or green colors some languages have. It's actually quite common for people to not make the distinction between blue and green. Languages ranging from Gaelic to Turkish to Zulu either treat blue and green as two shades of the same color, or they used to. One of the first people to discover this phenomenon, although he didn't know at the time that this was the phenomenon he was discovering, was Victorian-era British Prime Minister William Gladstone. This was in the days when a good education was synonymous with the classical canon, when it was not that likely for a world leader to have ever studied calculus, economics, or game theory, but they had definitely studied Latin and ancient Greek to the point of near fluency. Gladstone was no exception. In fact, outside of politics, Gladstone was also one of his era's top experts on Homer, the ancient Greek author, not the cartoon character. And he noticed that Homer seemed to see the world in a strange array of colors. In the Iliad, honey is described as green, the sky is bronze, people and sheep have violet hair. One of Homer's most famous lines to this day is the description of the Mediterranean Sea as wine dark. Although, whether that's an example of Homer describing colors weird or just poetic license is open to a lot of debate. What's not open to debate is that Homer described colors weird. Gladstone painstakingly noted the number of times something is described with a color in the Iliad and the Odyssey put together. There are 170 uses of the color black. About 100 things are described as white. Those two vastly outnumber the rest combined. 13 things are red, 10 things are violet, although it's not totally clear if that color should translate as violet, and 6 things are yellow. A word usually translated into English as green appears a couple of times, but the things it describes are not necessarily green. Forests and meadows get described in detail, but with no colors other than black and white. Same with the sky and the ocean. There is not a single reference to the color blue. Gladstone speculated that, quote, "I conclude then that the organ of color and its impressions were but partially developed among the Greeks of the heroic age." And why would this be? Well, Gladstone surmised that maybe the ancient Greeks didn't see much color because their dry, rocky Mediterranean world, predating the invention of modern-day paints and dyes and stained glass, was pretty colorless. The olive hue of the skin kept down the play of white and red. The hair tended much more uniformly than with us to darkness. The sense of color was less exercised by the culture of flowers. The sun sooner changed the spring greens of the earth into brown. Glass, one of our instruments of instruction, did not exist. The rainbow would much more rarely meet the view. The art of painting was wholly, and that of dyeing was almost, unknown, and we must estimate the importance of the element of this case by recollecting how much, with the advance of chemistry, the taste of this country in color has improved within the last 20 years. The artificial colors with which the human eye was conversant were chiefly the ill-defined and anything but full-bodied tints of metals. The materials, therefore, of the system of color did not offer themselves to Homer's vision as they do to ours. In other words, Gladstone seems to be arguing something like that Calvin and Hobbes comic where Calvin asks his dad why old photos are in black and white, and his dad responds that color didn't exist in the past, and the world came into color in the 1930s. Speculation aside, Gladstone was onto something, and it's not only Homer. That pattern, Gladstone discovered, most things get described in black and white, occasionally things that are clearly red, like blood or wine, are described as red, then all the other colors are very rarely used and often seem to describe things that obviously aren't that color, and there's never any mention of blue. That pattern is common across millennia of ancient literature. The German classicist Lazarus Geiger, who independently discovered the same thing as Gladstone at about the same time, in his case from reading Vedic texts from ancient India, had this fantastic quote about the Vedas. "These hymns of more than 10,000 lines are brimming with descriptions of the heavens. Scarcely is there any subject talked about more frequently than the sun and the reddening dawn's play of color, day and night, cloud and lightning. The air and the ether are unfolded before us, and over in splendor and vivid fullness. But there's only one thing that no one would ever learn from those ancient songs who do not already know it. And that is that the sky is blue." In the 1960s, two linguists, Brent Berlin and Paul Kay, formulated what they claimed to be a near-universal law of how languages describe color. In their book, basic color terms, their universality, and evolution, they wrote that everyone the world over perceives the same 11 basic colors. Black, white, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, purple, pink, brown, and gray. But how they describe them varies by language in a finding that Berlin and Kay described as totally unexpected. There's a predictable pattern for what languages have words for what colors, and it perfectly matches the pattern Gladstone discovered in Homer. Berlin and Kay appropriately divided the classes of linguistic color terms into 7 stages. Stage 1, all languages have words for light and dark. Stage 2, if your language has a third color word, it's the word for red. Stage 3, if a language has a fourth color word, it's either green or yellow, but not both. Stage 4, if a language has a fifth color word, both green and yellow are separately defined, but blue is considered a shade of green. Stage 5, you get a word for blue. Stage 6, you get a word for brown. And stage 7, you get words for orange, pink, purple, and or gray. They allowed that there might be an 8th stage that incorporates languages that separate blue into 2 colors, like Russian, or that split red into 2 colors. Hungarian does that. Where are the other colors? In a language so simple that the only words for colors are white, black, and red, like some languages in New Guinea and the Amazon, how do you describe something that's blue? If it's the ocean, you most likely say it's dark. If it's the sky, you say it's bright. You could liken it to something else, but what? The sky and the ocean are the two most obvious blue things people encounter in their day-to-day lives. There aren't a lot of blue foods, blue animals, even naturally blue flowers are pretty rare. The only things you'd have to compare the ocean and sky to are each other. And those aren't the same color. Not in a language that defines most colors by light and dark. One is dark, and the other is light. When a language first evolves a term for red, it tends to cover all warm colors. Gradually, other colors split off from it, and the original term stays exclusively referring to what we know as red. Brent and Kay give the example of Tiv, a Nigerian language with 3 basic color terms. In Tiv, all green, some blue, and some grays are E. But very light blues and light grays are pupu. Nyan, which covers brown, also covers all warm colors through red to yellow. E is dark, sort of. Pupu is light, sort of. And nyan is red, sort of. According to Berlin and Kay's theories, after centuries, possibly millennia of linguistic evolution, Tiv will have words for all 11 basic colors English has words for, and E will directly translate to black, pupu to white, and nyan to red. They make a decent case for this. Berlin and Kay painstakingly go through the history of color terms in dozens of languages, some widely spoken, some obscure, seemingly finding this consistent pattern all the time. Why is this a pattern? Well, that's the biggest mystery. Berlin and Kay don't speculate. They're just describing the pattern they've discovered. The process of color word evolution continues to this day. What I said closer to the beginning about how Japanese has the same word for green and blue isn't true anymore. Over the past 100 years or so, the word ao, which referred to both green and blue, has come to exclusively mean blue, while Midori has come into use as a common word for green. Sometimes ao is still used to refer to green spring foliage, especially in poetic and historical contexts, even though to the modern ear, ao only means blue. Is this weird? Not really, because it happened in English too. English moved from Berlin and Kay's stage 6 to stage 7 in relatively recent times. We've also seen one major color divide into two over the past few hundred years. Orange! Yeah, that's right. When oranges, the fruit, were introduced to Europe from the Middle East and originally from India, oranges were described as being red, a yellowish shade of red. Only after the fruit was common did English speakers begin to mentally segregate the color orange from red. Sir Isaac Newton included orange separately from red in his 7 color partitioning of the rainbow, but again, he chose 7 colors for pretty arbitrary reasons, initially only seeing 5 colors, and then throwing in orange alongside indigo, which most people don't really consider more than a shade of purple to this day. Just like poetic uses of ao in Japanese to describe things that modern Japanese people consider Midori, English still has vestiges of the time orange was considered a shade of red. Why are tigers commonly described as being orange, but foxes, which are a similar color, considered red? Because the English-speaking world became aware of tigers after we became aware of oranges. Whereas when oranges arrived on English shores, we'd been living alongside foxes for millennia. I had a great misunderstanding in one of my Chinese classes in Beijing, in which I was describing in class how white people's hair varies in color a lot more than Chinese people's hair. White people's hair can be black, brown, yellow, red, to which my teacher said, "Red? There are people with naturally red hair?" And I was like, "Of course! Like, in Ireland, lots of people have red hair." And she kept insisting that there's no way that exists. And I finally said, "Do you know about Harry Potter's friend Ron? Ron has red hair." And that got her to say, "Oh, you mean orange hair." So I said, "Yes, I do mean orange hair. I knew the Chinese word for orange, but we call it red." So I imagine a Japanese student learning English announcing that in the spring in Japan, all the leaves turn a beautiful blue. And after everyone else in the room is like, "Blue? Seriously?" Sheepishly admitting that everyone knows it's green, but they call it blue for contingent historical reasons most people don't know about. Maybe in the future, the English language will completely move beyond the vestige of the time before orange was a color. Everything orange will be described as orange, and everyone will be baffled by historical references to an apparently vanished race of Celtic people who had red hair. Historians will debate whether or not they're just talking about gingers. Let's return to the color Qing. Seems like Qing is one of those green-blue colors, then, right? After all, it uses the same character as the Japanese kanji for ao. Over the past few centuries in China, we watched a language move from stage 4 to stage 5 of Berlin and Kay's scale, as the word Qing fell away and words previously used for two shades of Qing became green and blue, right? Even the weirder uses of the word Qing can be massaged to fit this theory. Maybe in the past, the black stones in Go were blue or green. Maybe they made the stones that weren't white out of jade or something, and only in relatively recent history did they start being black. After all, ancient Chinese had plenty of other words for colors. Confucianism identifies 5 basic colors: black, white, yellow, red, and Qing, which sounds like a textbook example of Berlin and Kay's stage 4. Chinese isn't a stage 2 language like Tiv, in which they have to lump green, blue, black, and gray into the same color because they don't have individual terms for them, right? Right? But Qing definitely seems to encompass green, blue, black, and gray, even though there was an independent word for black that coexisted with Qing. There was even an independent word for blue, or some shades of blue, going back that far too, and there's even a Confucian proverb that refers to Qing as being more intense than blue, separating the two. Berlin and Kay's stages don't seem to apply here. The word he for black is itself thousands of years old, but plenty of black things are traditionally considered Qing, not he. The word shuanqing, incorporating the character Qing, means pitch black, complete darkness. If a Chinese person has beautiful, luscious black hair, that can be described as qingsi, analogous to the epithet raven-haired in English. Speaking of ravens, in Chinese mythology, Si Wangmu, the goddess of the West, is attended to by qingniao, Qing birds, which are usually depicted in present-day art as being blue-green like peacocks, but sometimes Si Wangmu is associated with a different mythological bird, three-legged crows. And sometimes the qingniao are traditionally described as having three legs too, so I think they're the same thing. They're crows. Qing, in the case of qingniao, means black. Black and shiny. Iridescent black, like a crow's feather. Or like well-groomed black hair. Or like the black stones in Go. Wait a minute. Let's let our friend William Gladstone talk again. I can see him jumping up and down raising his hand. In his writings on Homer, Gladstone made it sound like he was claiming that the ancient Greeks were all colorblind. In fact, even in Gladstone's own time, people misinterpreted him this way, which made him respond, clarifying that that wasn't what he meant. Which is why it's so annoying to see people repeating this to this day. William Gladstone wrote that Homer couldn't see blue. William Gladstone thought that the ancient Greeks were all colorblind, even in sources that I like to think I trust. Radiolab, one of my biggest influences on this channel, ran an episode about Homer, Gladstone, and the history of basic color terms in 2012, in which they uncritically repeated Gladstone's quote about the organ of color and its impressions, and said, almost verbatim, that Gladstone thought all the Greeks were colorblind. Never once did they mention that Gladstone himself directly said he never meant this. He clarified what he meant, and it was something far more interesting. He said, "My meaning was substantially this, that Homa operated, in the main, upon a quantitative scale with white and black, or light and dark, for its opposite extremities, instead of the qualitative scale opened by the diversities of color." Berlin and Kay believed that separating colors by light and dark is just a phase that languages go through when they don't have a lot of words for other colors yet. Eventually, they thought, all languages converge on the same 11 well-defined colors, a cultural universal. But what if it's not? Let's return to the visible light spectrum. We see it as 7 colors because that's how Newton decided to divvy it up. But this entire spectrum only demonstrates one aspect of color, and that's the hue. As Westerners, we're used to defining colors by hue. If you ask for a definition of the word hue, I think most people would say it's a synonym for color. It's not. It's 1/3 of what makes up color. The Munsell color chart, arguably the most influential modern system used to classify color, groups colors by hue, value, and chroma, which is also called saturation. Hue means the extent to which one color can be differentiated from another. Then there's value, which means brightness. 0% value is black, 100% value is white. Chroma, or saturation, means how colorful the color is. 0% saturation is gray, 100% saturation is full color. Everything in between looks increasingly dull the lower the chroma percentage is. It's not universal to define colors by hue. What seems to be more natural is to group colors by saturation and brightness. Berlin and Kay were touching one part of the proverbial elephant. They were, more or less, right about the order in which color terms develop. But it didn't occur to them that not every language evolves toward the same 11 colors. Ancient Greek, contra Gladstone, had plenty of words for colors, including a word, kianos, that today gets used to mean blue. But like most ancient Greek colors, the way it's used in the myths doesn't perfectly match the modern perception of blue. Homer describes Zeus's eyebrows as kianos at one point. I want to believe that Zeus canonically had blue hair, but Homer probably meant black. Here is classicists' best attempt at reconstructing an ancient Greek color wheel. Grouping colors by brightness and warmth rather than hue, you get two words for black. Kianos, which also encompasses dark blue, and melas, which also encompasses dark shades of warm colors. If the sky ever got described, it was lampros, which could be silvery or light blue. It was a bright, shiny color. Here's a Munsell color chart where I've marked out the area that I think maps onto the Chinese understanding of Qing. In the Munsell system, chroma seems to be the value that defines ancient Chinese color the most. Colors that are brighter but less saturated are lan or lu, blue or green. Decrease the brightness and increase the saturation, and you get to Qing. The just-so story I'd tell about it is this. You have to have words for light and dark. The most vivid, visible color, the one that's hardest to map onto a light-dark spectrum, is red, so that comes next. Green is a very common color in nature. There are plenty of things you can point to and say green, so that's next, especially since it's not a warm color that could be covered by the mental color space of red. It's close enough to yellow that it can cover that, maybe, but as the bridge between cold and warm colors, you might as well have an independent name for yellow, too. The hardest stage to make the jump to is stage 4-5, evolving a word for blue. Plenty of cultures only did that after Western contact, and of all the basic color terms, the term for blue is most likely to be a loanword from another language. Without Western influence, plenty of languages wouldn't have progressed up Berlin and Kay's scale at all. They'd end up with 11 or 12 basic colors, probably, but 11 or 12 basic colors that don't necessarily map onto any colors we know. The claims that ancient Greeks, or any culture, quote-unquote, couldn't see blue are bullshit. But they didn't consider blue to be a single color. Again, only two unambiguously blue things were common sights in pre-modern times. Blue dye was incredibly hard to come by. And the two universal blue things, open water and clear skies, really aren't the same shade. I think that it's not innate to human nature at all to see the sea and the sky as the same color. which may be why Russian, long after developing a word for blue, divided it again into two colors. The Sini-Golubovy distinction is relatively recent. A couple hundred years ago, Russian had just one word for blue, Sini, and Golubovy was a shade of it. But maybe that was a stirring of something primordial. The reason there's no blue in ancient texts is because the ancients tended to see light blue and dark blue as different colors, each of which encompassed what we'd consider other colors too, and perhaps that's the default human perception of it. So, what if that hypothetical, cool middle school teacher was right? What if we all see colors differently? Not physiologically, the same wavelength of light hits your eye no matter who you are, but the languages we speak color our perception. Russians would never say, English speakers can't see the color Golubovy. I can see them. My temporary background is Sini, and my shirt is Golubovy. But even knowing that Sini is dark blue and Golubovy is light blue, I cannot see the mysterious Golubovy-ness of Golubovy the same way I can see the mysterious redness of red. If I trained myself to see them as separate colors, maybe I could, but as I am, I can't. I'd have to think about whether something blue is Sini or Golubovy for just a split second, sure, but I don't have to think at all about whether something is red or orange. Studies have shown that English speakers have a slower response time than Russians in identifying the lighter swatch of blue amid blue squares that are all otherwise darker. They're also worse at remembering which square was the lighter one. We're seeing the same hue, we're just mentally classifying it as a different color, and that's just in a language that partitions the color wheel in almost exactly the same way as English. The Russians just draw one more line than we do. I cannot come close to seeing the mysterious Qingness of Qing. Which makes me think about consciousness itself. Color perception is by far the most common example of qualia, a word philosophers use for individual subjective experiences that differentiate conscious humans from machines or zombies that simply respond to stimuli. When I look up at a clear sky, it's not just that the light of a particular blue wavelength is hitting my eye. A machine could perceive that wavelength as blue too. I am supposedly experiencing the mysterious blueness of blue. That's what means I'm conscious. I'm not a philosophical zombie. A hypothetical being that's exactly like a human, but doesn't have qualia. A philosophical zombie, usually abbreviated to P-zombie, is an entity that would be completely indistinguishable from a human in every way, the only difference being that all it does is respond to stimuli. When a P-zombie lies down on the grass and looks up at the sky, they can say, "Look how blue the sky is. Look at the mysterious blueness of blue." But they're only saying that because light of a blue wavelength is hitting their eye. They're not actually seeing the mysterious blueness of blue. They seem conscious in every possible way, but they're not. Some philosophers don't believe qualia exist. They'll say that we are just responding to stimuli. That we are conscious, sure, right? We are conscious, right? But so is that zombie. We are all effectively P-zombies, and there is no mysterious blueness of blue. This resonated with me for a while. There's no strong argument for the existence of qualia. This lack of evidence is known as the hard problem of consciousness, summarizable as, if we know consciousness exists because we are conscious, why is there no clear evidence of it? The fact that people in different cultures have looked at what is obviously, objectively, the same color and classified it in so many different ways is the best argument I know for the existence of qualia. As I said at the start of the video, I now live in New York, not far from Central Park. While the weather's still nice, I'd like to invite someone specific to come have a picnic with me by the possibly wine-dark Onassis Reservoir on the bright green grass. That someone is the 4th century BCE Taoist philosopher Zhuangzi, famous for a somewhat related argument about consciousness, in which he woke from a dream where he was a butterfly, wondering if he might really be a butterfly, dreaming that he's Zhuangzi. Well, if you are one, butterflies are good at migration. Come to New York, Zhuangzi. It's not as far as you think. It's not a date. I'm sorry, man, I've got a girlfriend, but we'll have a good time. You can get some pretty good dumplings in Manhattan. We'll pack them up in one of those oyster pails. You gotta see those. Those are fun. And we'll lie on our backs, beside the reservoir and look up at the sky, and I'll say, "Do you see the mysterious blueness of blue?" And you'll say, "Yeah." And I'll say, "The same color as the reservoir, right?" And you'll say, "No." There was a different man who read Homer once who found something even weirder within the text, and used it to discover a much stranger theory than ancient civilizations couldn't see blue. One that questioned whether ancient civilizations were conscious in the same way we are at all. But that is another story, and will be told another time. One mystery remains. Those fucking yellow trucks. If you're American, you know them. They're the capital Y yellow trucks, but they are not the color yellow. There's a trucking company called Yellow, and their logo is clearly, unambiguously orange. I want to believe that that's a deliberate attempt at confusing future William Gladstones, in which case, based.
Man and